Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. On today's show, David Wallace Wells from New York Magazine will explain why the United States has it wrong when it comes to the way we test for COVID-19. Heather Digby-Parton will join me to analyze the news this week. And if you're listening to the free podcast right now, do us a favor. Support the show. You can help us out by becoming a member over at ROFpodcast.com. Don't forget, we are opening up the show to everyone. We're not paywalling any part of it through this COVID-19 era, as it were. But your support makes this show possible. Head over to ROFpodcast.com. Here to break down this week in news, Heather Digby-Parton from the blog Hullabaloo and the site Salon.com. So, Heather, we spoke to David Wallace Wells about the essentially the, I guess, the state of the science that we have in terms of COVID-19 at this point. But the amazingly, what the story really is, and I referenced something like this to him, was that when historians look back on this, and I imagine also people, you know, you don't have to look, you don't really need hindsight for this, that the real story in terms of America's dealing with this pandemic is overwhelmingly political. I mean, it's not even bureaucratic, because for this to be a story about bureaucratic incompetence, there would need to be a will to deal with it. And there is the opposite of a political will to deal with it. It has been stunning. And it's not only been stunning. Well, I mean, we're seeing the value of states' rights in practice in some way, I guess, because the federal government has been completely beyond absent in its response to COVID-19. The Trump administration has been hostile to people who are trying to do something to deal with this pandemic. And as a function of what has now become Republican dogma, and both in terms of the way it's expressed with the legislature and the federal, for the Senate, I should say, and the president, not providing funds for states and for cities, has added to this political dogma where you have Republican governors also virulently, I don't know how else to express it, virulently attempting to thwart attempts to deal with COVID-19. It's beyond bizarre.
Beyond bizarre is for sure. I mean, this is just, this is sort of rank partisan ignorance all the way down. I mean, you know, even if you go down all the way down to cities and city councils and school boards, you're finding this same phenomenon. It's amazing. Here in California, where I am, for instance, they had, you know, the state had been, you know, as all states are, sort of forced to handle whatever happened by themselves, because, as you point out, the federal government has been completely lacking in any, except to the extent that they think it might help Donald Trump get reelected, and they don't even understand that part of it. They have been completely asleep at the wheel, just threw everything to the states, and the federal government didn't even do the one thing that they could have done without really much effort, which would be to just pass some bills to, you know, bail out the states and the local governments, and to provide money. I mean, they did provide some, but, you know, it's looking very, very dicey whether or not they're going to continue that, and basically the Congress just, you know, went home and said, well, you know, Adios. See you. It's been grand. Hope everything works out. And so in the States, you even have things like, you know, here in California where, you know, the governor, they shut down early. They did all the right things. And now we've got a big surge because when they started to open up, people just went back out, apparently, unlike New Yorkers who understood that when you open back up, you need to be very careful. Californians did not, and as a result, we've got this surge. So the governor did the right thing, and he's shutting down. These school districts are all looking at the fall, going, what are we going to do? We're in the middle of this surge, et cetera, et cetera. You've got Orange County School Board there saying, no, we don't even, no masks. We don't want any masks. The kids have to go back to school 5 days a week. They're, you know, we don't care. The teachers, we don't have the PPE, but that's okay. You're just going to have to handle it because it is a Republican school board in the middle of a surge is saying that sort of thing. I read this story about the two competing events in Utah where one of the one of them was a city council meeting, I think, or maybe it was a school board meeting, where they were talking about starting school again, and these people were screaming that their kids were going to have to wear masks in school, just absolutely refusing to accept that this was something, again, conservatives. And, you know, you're finding this all over the country. I mean, it just seems to me that this whole thing has exposed a dysfunction on a level that goes way beyond anything I think we knew. I mean, you know, I think that we always kind of assume that America, you know, was screwed up as we were, as divided, as polarized, whatever, that there was still some sort of basic level of competence or desire to be competent in an emergency. You'd think about, you know, what happened if there's a war or some massive natural disaster, the asteroid hit, something like that. Well, it happened. This pandemic happened, and it has exposed us as being politically so dysfunctional that we basically cannot do anything. I mean, you know, you're finding situations where people in small groups in certain regions and states and various localities, they kind of pull themselves together and make it work out for the small local community. But, you know, as far as a country is concerned, I mean, we are flailing. And you are right. When the historians look back on this, they're going to, you know, what in the world happened? We're the most, you know, supposedly the most technologically advanced country in the world, the wealthiest. Certainly, you know, we've been running the world to all intents and purposes for the last 60 years. And here we are hit with a crisis that is, you know, obviously other countries have shown that it can be dealt with. It's not the Martians landing. This isn't Independence Day. I mean, this is something that is can be competently dealt with. And we just can't do it. And it just gets worse and worse and worse. I mean, I confess, I didn't have much hope. But I didn't think it'd be this bad in July. I really didn't. I did not think it would be this bad in July.
There were signs as to what was happening in the southern states, you know, 5 or 6 weeks ago. But when this started, you know, the plan was you flatten the curve to avoid a rush at the hospitals so that you don't overwhelm your medical system and overreach your capacity to provide medical care for people who need it urgently. And simultaneously, you buy time to help with supply lines of PPE, to expand your capacity to test people for the virus. I mean, look, there is a normal capacity that we have in this country with labs to test blood, right? And they have a sense, having developed this sense over years, maybe decades, frankly, is just what the demand is going to be to test blood at any given time. And they have facilities and machines and people hired to match what they perceive is going to be the demand. And this isn't, you know, this isn't like, I'm trying to think of something you can ramp up quickly, but it's, you know, this is not, we got a lot of people coming to the movies tonight. We need to make a lot more popcorn. I mean, you know, these are lab technicians. and these are our facilities. And so the idea was, we're buying time to invest, to have some party invest a tremendous amount of money for a one-off type of situation,
right?
Which is a pandemic. And there is no entity out there, certainly not in the private market, who's going to say, oh, we're going to hire a bunch of people and build out and invest in capital expenses for a demand that may not be here in a year. Like, nobody's going to do that. And so you need the federal government to step in and do this and build out that capacity so that when we spend a certain period of time not engaging with other people and we start to go out, hopefully in a responsible way, wearing masks, that there will be a testing capacity so that everyone can get tested. People who don't think they have symptoms, but, you know, for whatever reason, you can get tested. You can get that response back within a day. I mean, preferably within an hour. And you can know, oh, I have this. I need to self-quarantine. And once I have that information, there will have been, because of that 2 or 3 month period, an ability to trace everyone you've had contacts with. I mean, this is what every developed country on the planet has done when faced with this threat, except for the United States of America. There has been no expansion of testing. So now, unless you have extreme symptoms, it can take up to 14 days to get a test back.
Insane.
That is definitionally useless. It's completely useless. 14 days is useless. You don't need the test because you have cycled through or you've gotten God knows how many people infected over the course of that period of time. And as far as contact tracing, I know for a fact there was an attempt about 6 to 8 weeks ago by specific states to develop an app. Multiple states were looking to develop apps to contact trace, and then they just gave up because there was no funding and no support from the federal government. And so we are just adrift in the midst of this pandemic with a president and a right-wing, you know, Medal of Freedom winner handed to by that president, telling us we've got to buck up and get used to it. And Rush Limbaugh was saying, hey, look at the Donner Party. They started cannibalism, but yet you've got people complaining about a pandemic. I mean, this is insanity. It's insanity. And it is stunning. I mean, I wonder if the veil of American exceptionalism will be in any way punctured by this amongst, the vast majority of people. Maybe not, because there's just no way for people to fully understand, like, wait a second, many of the countries in Europe now have returned to more or less a version of normal. And we can't do that here. It's crazy.
I think it already has for some people. And yet there seems to be this, I don't even know how to describe it, this kind of willful ignorance in which people are determined to turn this into just another, you know, battle in the culture war, and refuse to see what is actually happening. I mean, we've got refrigerator trucks now coming into places in Texas and Arizona because they've run out of morgue space, and yet we have, and apparently that's okay. Mike Pence was out there saying that nurses and doctors and other healthcare workers have to start reusing their PPE again. I mean, this is just shades of what we went through in April in New York. It's the same thing. I mean, the numbers are slightly less, but that's just because the virus was raging for, you know, quite a bit of time before this happened. In fact, I read an interesting article the other day saying that really when you go back and trace what happened in New York, it's not all that different than watching it unfold in places like Arizona, Texas, and Florida, and now Georgia, too. And so, you know, I don't know. I honestly don't know how to explain what's happened to us in this. I mean, you know, I think Donald Trump and the election of him and the, you know, the previous decade and a half of American politics, going all the way back to, you know, maybe the, you know, the Clinton years, when things started to really go off the rails here, something, you know, this is really a major kind of societal cultural problem in which, you know, people can't seem to, and some of it, I guess, has to do with the media, but I don't think that fully explains it, that, you know, people just cannot grapple with reality. I mean, the reality is we're in the middle of a major, major crisis that other countries are handling, and we aren't. And, you know, I don't really see people kind of grasping that. And I'm not sure it's all political either, Sam, because, you know, here in California, the minute that Gavin Newsom started to open up the state, which they waited, you know, they didn't do it until June. They closed down early. They flattened the curve. They did all the things that were supposed to be done. The minute that they opened things up, people just started acting as if everything was normal. They just went into the bars. They went in to, you know, started shopping like normal. I mean, there was nothing, you know, no masks, no anything. And, you know, that information was out there. That wasn't a failure of messaging. People knew it. I knew it. I knew that the pandemic was still with us, but people did that anyway. And, of course, we know where that led, right? Now we're in the middle of a hot spot here in California with, you know, people dying. I mean, we're not to the refrigerator truck stage yet, but, you know, who knows? We might get there. So you know, I don't honestly know, but it's kind of, I mean, this is really disorienting, the fact that America, the richest country in the world, is unable to handle this thing in any kind of a functional way. And part of it has to do with Donald Trump. A huge part of it has to do with the Republican Party. But there's also something really disturbing about our culture, I think, that we're going to have to take a look at. The historians will be looking at that as well. Let's just put it that way.
I mean, I think that's true. I think that's true. But I will say this, that I do think the absence of a concerted, cohesive message coming from the leadership of the country, and the way that filters out. Now, I don't listen to Donald Trump, but the fact of the matter is that there are people who I interact with, not directly in the context of COVID-19. I have a rather small pod, but people, you know, like, former in-laws who, putting pressure on my, my ex and kids to go out and celebrate and this and that. And they're not taking it seriously. And it becomes, you know, this is an exhausting time for people. It is a relentless time. And anything that can help undermine your self-discipline, I think people will grasp. I mean, it's, you know, it is, as someone who, you know, some extent struggles with my weight over the years, sometimes, you know, if someone says, like, you look really thin, I'm, you know, like, you know what? I'm going to have that piece of chocolate cake, that extra piece. And like, I think that's human nature. And so the lack of seriousness from the people who should know, I think, impacts everybody. And I don't think it's like, it's a difference between it being partisan. But I think the partisanness, you know, even though it has become this sort of like partisan divide on how serious to take this, it's very difficult to walk out and see other people living it up and not starting to cut corners yourself. I think that's very, you know, I think that's a very human response. And
you're absolutely right.
It is that.
I mean, here in California, when they opened up, and I'm walking down, this, taking my constitutional in my neighborhood here in Santa Monica, and I'm walking there, and everybody's sitting in bars and restaurants, and it's summertime, it's beautiful, they're sitting there having a drink and chattering with their friends, and boy, did I feel that yearning, you know? I mean, I felt it in, you know, deep inside, God, what would I give to just have, you know, a nice evening with my friends and, you know, sit here at the beach and, you know, have a drink and whatever. And it very, very tempting. And tempting to just maybe throw caution to the wind and say, hey, you know, maybe I should just take my chances here and just do it. I didn't, of course, because, you know, I'm not insane. But I felt it. So you're right. It's not fair to really, you know, say there's some deep dysfunction when you have a situation where the message is not particularly consistent. And so people are going to grasp at whatever they, you know, can see is maybe something they really want to do.
And you imagine, like, you know, you take a place like Georgia where this week Kemp said, you know, it's illegal to for a city to or a town to mandate mask wearing. Like, that's not even like inconsistent. That is like, that's completely contradictory.
Defiant.
I mean, it is like, we're not even going to allow communities the ownership over whether they protect themselves. And I just, man, it's nuts. And, you know, the only, I hesitate to say this is a silver lining, because I, you know, it's pretty thin gruel. And I think, you know, before COVID, I think there was a very good chance of a Joe Biden winning in November. And I think there was a significant chance of the Democrats taking the Senate. And I, you know, knock on wood, we have been down this road before. Sometimes a 1-7 odds can cut against you. Right. That's what, you know, if Donald Trump had a 15% chance of winning, it's, you know, 1-7 odds. Sometimes that horse comes in, as it were. But it is looking increasingly like the Democrats are going to control every branch of government come November. Now, you don't want to encourage any complacency, and I find it hard to believe that anybody listening to this show anyways, you know, will be complacent in any way, frankly, because, you know, we are watching the assault. And I think, you know, of our institutions, of our democratic institutions, sometimes I think it sounds too heady to say democratic institutions, but our governing institutions are, yeah, you know, like the FDA, like the CDC, for example, like, you know, basic functions that are supposed to be apolitical, at least in the way that they're, you know, theoretically, that they are supposed to function. Like, you know, I don't know why you have a CDC if they're being sidelined and people have lost confidence in them during a pandemic. I mean, like, that to me seems to be sort of like the time when you need a CDC, right? Like, that's,
yeah.
I mean, I'm sure there are other circumstances, but pandemic seems to be like, I don't know, mission statement. That would be number one, it strikes, it seems to me, right? Like, yet.
That's what they do, I thought.
And yet, it's been completely, thoroughly undercut, destroyed, mismanaged, fallen into ill repute in many respects.
Well, yeah, and I mean, just look what happened this past week with this, you know, obvious attempt on the part of the White House to discredit Dr. Anthony Fauci from the National Institute of Health. I mean, he is the one of the foremost scientists in the world. in studying and dealing with infectious disease. There's no doubt about it. People throughout the world, you know, look up to him, have studied with him. I mean, this guy is definitely one of the best. And, you know, we've all been looking at him as kind of the voice of, you know, I mean, he has not been hysterical. He hasn't been apocalyptic about this thing. He's been very measured and been quite political in a lot of ways, trying to sort of keep the baby in the White House appeased and doing, you know, all of this. But they went out of their way to discredit him this week and say he's been wrong. And this has been something Trump has been mumbling for some time. It's not new. He does not like the fact that Fauci is popular, you know, in polling, and he doesn't like the fact that Fauci is at times contradicting his, you know, ridiculously optimistic sunny view that the virus is just going to go away on its own. I mean, Fauci has not been saying that, I mean, obviously. So they go out, they go through this big, you know, routine this week where they're, you know, putting out oppo research on him and out sending it anonymously to the press. And then they, Peter Navarro, the economist guy who apparently has been at loggerheads with Fauci from the beginning, and there's a story of how they met at some task force meeting, and Navarro's a big hydroxychloroquine guy, and he threw down a bunch of papers and said, "What about this?" in the middle of the meeting, and they got into it. But in any case, you know, it's just like what you say about the CDC. Here you have a world-renowned authority on the very thing that we are dealing with, somebody who you could turn to, and any other president would have, right? Any other president would have had coronavirus briefings on a daily basis, probably with some czar, and it wouldn't have been Pence. It would have been somebody with some credibility, and Dr. Fauci. And they would have been up there holding these briefings for the American people to put out the government's latest information, guidance, recommendations, and it would go out to all the people, and we'd all be sitting there going, "Gee, what did Dr. Fauci say today? You know, what should we do?" You know, we'd all be on that page. Any other president would have done that, but Trump, because he's an egomaniac and a narcissist, he wanted to be the guy, and he inserted himself into the whole briefing situation there. You recall those ridiculous coronavirus rallies that he was holding, and basically destroyed that whole concept as something that you could use as a way to give people some sort of, you know, national voice, a fireside chat, if you will, something where you could go and say, "Gee, what's the latest? What do we do now? You know, how's the coronavirus going?" You know, so he ruined that with his absurdity, you know, and talking about the hydroxy and talking about, you know, injecting disinfectant and the rest of the silly things that he did. We have these institutions that are there for this purpose. This is what you want a CDC for. This is what you want an NIH for. This is what you have these apolitical institutions that, you know, who, by the way, are not perfect. And, you know, they all make mistakes, but that's science for you, right? I mean, science doesn't come out and say, "Hey, we are the final word and there's nothing." They change all the time, and nobody knew what was happening with this virus in the beginning. So there were mistakes. Mistakes were made in New York. I mean, there were mistakes made all over the place. But that's something people can grapple with. What we can't grapple with is this completely bizarre mixture of messages that everything's going great, open up, we're going to put people in the pews and the businesses are going to be open. And on the other side, you've got refrigerator trucks coming in because they don't have enough space in the morgue. I mean, this is the kind of thing that has people confused. And you're right. I mean, this is a situation that is exacerbated. I mean, if there's something going on in our culture, which I think, you know, I mean, look at these QAnon people, right? I mean, what he tells you, there's something weird happening. That, you know,
that, and the fact that half a dozen of them are the Republican candidates for
exactly.
Congress.
They're being elected to the Congress, these you know, complete nuts. You know, there's something weird happening. But nonetheless, had there been even the slightest bit of you know, sort of efficiency even on the part of the federal government. And, you know, I mean, this is one of those weird things that I just don't understand, because this wouldn't have been that hard. What was, maybe you can answer this, what was Trump's resistance to deploying the Defense Production Act. Where did that come from? And where did it come from that he couldn't use the Pentagon's, you know, Defense Logistics Agency, which is 26,000 people they have, which is deployed to send armies all over the world. They could have gotten PPE where it was necessary. Why did he reject that? Do you know?
My guess is that it was Jared's decision largely, and that there was money to be made. Why are we going to have the government have specific entities make this at a narrow profit margin when we can when there are donors and maybe business partners who can make a ton of cash off of this? And I think that that message was reinforced by the Chamber of Commerce. And I think that's what it was. I think there's no other explanation for it. I mean, they wanted to make this, you know, that's the thing I think that people that I think, it, you know, I think that is clear about the White House to me anyways, is that Donald Trump has no operational ideas. I mean, occasionally I think things pop into his head and they do it, but it's like, you know, literally like everybody's going to wear underwear on their head tomorrow or something. But beyond that, what you have is a rogues gallery of Koch brother installed, you know, and I know one of them is dead, but that's Mike Pence is a Koch brother guy. Hardcore, you know, Freedom Caucus people, Mick Mulvaney, you know, what's his face? Who's in there now?
Mark Meadows.
I mean, these are the most sort of like hardcore business friendly, but also not even like necessarily corporate, but business friendly. And by business friendly, I mean, they perceive government as a tool to enhance their businesses. I mean, and I think, you know, if folks who live in small towns understand this dynamic, you know, Joe gets on the town planning board because he wants first dibs on either doling out those grants or those loans or where the road's going to go because it's next to his cousin's property. I mean, it's that level of corruption, I believe, that I think is going to be exposed, you know, ultimately when people start digging through the wreckage of this era. And, you know, one of the things you mentioned, Fauci. Look, Fauci, without a doubt, among other people, gave the wrong instructions to people in this country regarding masks.
Yeah.
From day one, they should have been saying, you don't need an N95 mask. You just need some type of face covering. It can be a handkerchief. It can be a bandana. It can be whatever. But when you go out, put this on there. And I don't know if they didn't respond this way because Western society just isn't, you know, now they are, but they just weren't sort of read into this in the way that Asian societies were, or because they had dealt with like MERS and SARS and other would-be epidemics, or if he was getting so much pushback in January, in December, in, you know, through early February, that he was still trying to stay within the good graces of the administration by not expressing anything that would appear to be, you know, universal in terms of like, we've all got to be worried about this. Because you know what was going on in the White House in January and February. It's just like, we can't have the stock market tank. And if you tell people to wear masks and make it sound like this is a serious thing, we're screwed. And so you better not say anything like that. Now, that could have been the calculation. I don't know. At one point, the guy will, somebody will write, you know, he'll write his memoirs or somebody will tell us. And so I don't know. It's, it really is hard to articulate what a mess this is now. And then the question is, if the Democrats do take over, I mean, if they don't, it's almost impossible to sort of contemplate what's going to happen.
Yeah.
I mean, it's conceivable that Donald Trump wins the election and then is like, you know what? We've got a big problem here. We got to pour money or not, right? Where it's like, you know, we're just going to let this thing play out. It doesn't matter. I've been elected. If the Democrats get into office, the calculation is going to be different. It is going to be, do they realize this is an opportunity to do things that are dramatic? And what one thing that strikes me right now that is, you know, sort of concerning me, you know, everybody's talking about, and this is a little far afield, but let's address it. Everybody's talking about these Lincoln group or whatever it is, the Lincoln Projects ads. And there's actually a wonderful tuning in the news, Colbert's cartoon show that sat down with Rick Wilson. And
it is
brilliant in my estimation, but it also doesn't get right to the heart of the matter. What the Lincoln Project is doing, in my mind, is certainly making people who are going to vote against Trump anyways feel good about themselves. But what they're also doing, which I think is going to be highly detrimental, is they are creating a narrative that their perspective was an important one in defeating Donald Trump. And they are trying to own part of the mandate that Joe Biden will have in if he is victorious and the Democrats would take the Senate. They are, and I don't know if it'll work, but they are trying to get a seat at that table as part of the mandate, at least within the context of the media. And I mean, you know how narrow things are determined, right, with these campaigns and with conventional wisdom. And that is a big concern to me. It is a big concern to me because, look, we've already seen versions of this take place within the context of the media. You know, I mean, if you watch MSNBC, when it came time to bomb Syria, all those never Trumpers who are out there, they're one of us. They're against Trump. To a person, they all came on MSNBC, and the only story that you heard throughout that night was, we need to do this. We need to bomb Syria. And I am afraid that is an illustration of what they're going to attempt to do and what could very well happen if the Democrats win. It's that part of this victory is going to be owned by them only because they had the money to go and spend and didn't necessarily deliver a vote. I don't think there's any data that suggests that they are changing any minds. Maybe I'm wrong, but I find it hard to believe because I don't know who their constituency is, frankly.
Well, I don't either, although there are, you know, I just read a thing on Gallup that the Republican Party identification, IDing as Republicans, has slipped dramatically just in the last couple of months. I'm not giving them credit for it, but there is some evidence that people aren't identifying as Republicans.
Part of that could be because they're elderly and they're watching literally Republicans go on and saying, we're willing to sacrifice grandma. I mean, literally, yeah. I mean, that was said by the lieutenant governor from Texas. So
exactly. Like, some of us just need to die. Maybe, you know, it's like culling the herd or whatever. You know, I mean, they are saying things like that. So I agree with you that that's a worry, but I'll tell you something. I honestly will be surprised if they have, I mean, their role at the moment is to say nasty things about Donald Trump, which, of course, we all enjoy, and they do it very cleverly, I think. And you're right. That's just telling people, you know, what they want to hear. But if you look at what Joe Biden is putting out, at least the ads that I've seen, it is a very, very different story that he's telling, which is his is about, it's not mean and nastiness. It's not, you know, let's go for the jugular. It's none of that. Now, and I kind of like jugular mean and nasty, and I'd like to see some of it used against Republicans in the Senate, especially if the Democrats win. You know, I don't want any let's all sing kumbaya and we're going to come together and heal the nation's wounds and we're not going to look backwards, we're going to look forwards. To me, that is the bigger threat, is that the story Biden's telling is, you know, look, we've got to unify as a nation, restore our soul and all that stuff. That's very, you know, heartrending and everything. But to me, you know, I'm more worried about the Democrats deciding that what we need to do is, you know, really just put all those troubles behind us and look forward, and let's just, you know, carry on and pretend like none of this, you know, unpleasantness happened. And I don't think that those Lincoln, you know, project guys are that. I mean, they're not the, you know, they're not the let's all get back together kind of people. They're the, you know, let's stick it to Donald Trump. So I'm not saying that I don't have similar worries to you, that these certain people are going to have a place at the table that I really wish didn't. But I think it might be coming from a different place than them, that it's going to be more of an institutional pushback, and that I see Democrats in the Congress and in the Senate, you know, kind of saying, you know, look, we don't want to fight anymore. We've got big things. We've got so much on our plate. We've got to solve all these problems. We can't really be fighting with Republicans. And I honestly, and, you know, to some extent, they do have a lot on their plate, not even to some extent. It's reality. There is a huge amount of work to be done. But none of that can be accomplished, in my view, without taking a look at what happened to the Department of Justice, without taking a look at what went on in the Trump administration, the vast amount of corruption, without looking at what's happened to the intelligence community and foreign policy and everything. And to me, you know, I think there should be a huge commission, if nothing else, to, you know, tasked with doing a full report on, you know, all the you know, the destruction that was wrought by this administration. I mean, I don't think that's going to happen. And that has me worried, because it just, you know, I mean, that means that it's all no harm, no foul, and that just can't be right. So anyway, I think we're talking in some respects about the same thing, but I think that you and I are maybe seeing it coming from different places, different weaknesses in the Democratic Party.
Oh, maybe I think there are multiple weaknesses.
Yeah, maybe.
Mine are not mutually exclusive necessarily.
Yeah, you're probably right.
Point taken. Well, look, Heather, this is something that we will have some time to ruminate on as the country, begins to various parts of the country begin to get more and more buried in these COVID infections. Until that time, until next week, I hope that you stay safe. And, you know, I almost feel like we have yet to develop the language that we're going to need, because I have a feeling now that we are going to be in one state or another like we are in now for a considerably longer time than one would have imagined even 2 or 3 months ago.
Sadly, I agree. Yeah,
and
I agree.
I wish we had some type of salutation beyond be safe, like, you know, may you have an easy quarantine or something to that effect.
That works. But,
may your quarantine be not so stressful. Heather Parton, always a pleasure.
Thanks for having me, Sam. I appreciate it.
Countries across the world are having some success at controlling the spread of COVID-19. But as we've discussed, not here in the United States. States like Arizona, Florida, Texas are seeing record-breaking numbers, almost at a daily rate. Here to explain why we failed to keep up with the rest of the world, David Wallace Wells from New York Magazine. So, David, here we are. It is the middle of July. We are now over 135,000 deaths. We this week it was reported that Texas and Arizona, Texas in particular, has ordered over a dozen FEMA movable morgues and mobile morgues. I think Arizona has ordered some as well. It's conceivable that we'll see that in Florida soon. California is having a spike. Now, Oklahoma is having issues, South Carolina. And you and I spoke on the Majority Report, I don't know, maybe a month or two ago. I can't really, to be honest with you, keep things straight.
What is time?
I don't know. I mean, let's start with this. From the perspective of the virus in and of itself, I mean, what are the things, where are we in terms of our knowledge about its transmittability?
Well, you know, in general, our understanding hasn't evolved that much over the last month or 6 weeks. You know, it's still a disastrously transmittable disease. There's still a huge lag between the time when you get the disease and when you start to feel symptoms. And maybe even most concerningly in trying to get a handle on it is the fact that as many as half of all transmission comes from asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic people, which means that, you know, if you're only testing people who feel sick, you're almost by design missing half or more of the problem. And that's really the state we're still in, even in those places where we're rolling out an enormous number of tests today. We're not doing surveillance level, population level testing. We're only doing testing of people who already feel sick. And those people are not getting test results for 5 days, 7 days, in some cases 2 weeks, which means the results are basically useless to them if they were, you know, either they should be or will, you know, quarantine preemptively, or by the time they get the results back, the period in which they should have been quarantining is over. And so this is a problem that has been, you know, facing the U.S. since January, February, when we were first thinking about the threat of COVID. Somehow 6 months later, it's no better. We have a testing apparatus, which while a lot bigger than it was in January or February, actually isn't all that much more effective in helping us control the disease. And that's one reason among many, why we're having such a catastrophic resurgence or second wave, or however you want to talk about what's happening now. You know, in truth, it's a little misleading to talk about it as a second wave, because in most places where there are dramatic outbreaks, they didn't have a first one. And there's, you know, when we conflate national data, it looks different than when you look at regions in particular. But in many parts of the country, you're going through something like what New York went through in the spring. And the scariest part is that, of course, there are many more parts of the country still that haven't yet done that. And because there is what the head of, or one of the doctors of the CDC called, so much virus in the country, it's going to be really, really hard to contain the spread such that we won't see many more outbreaks like those we're now seeing in Houston and Miami and all across Arizona, in all the rest of the country over the next few weeks and months. And that's, I think, one of the things that is scariest and most distressing, that people don't really yet seem to realize, that, you know, things are really bad right now, but they're going to get a lot worse. And that's true at the level of the disease. Personally, I'm even more worried about it, I think, at the level of the social and economic cost, because we had a report out this week showing that 28 million people may face eviction because of the crisis. We have, the moment, an 11% unemployment rate, but it's actually higher than that. That's sort of misleading. And the extended unemployment benefits are going to run out this month. We've got more than 5 million people who lost health insurance as a result of the pandemic. It's looking like almost nowhere in the country will schools be truly open in the fall, which means that all of those kids are going to lose at the very least 6 months of schooling and maybe more. You know, we're seeing suicides skyrocket, overdosing skyrocket, anxiety levels off the charts, Xanax prescriptions off the charts. And all of these costs, these psychic costs, these economic costs, these social costs, are going to get much, much worse in the fall, in part because the federal government is so disinterested in doing anything to cushion that suffering. And really the earliest relief we can start to hope for from the federal level is going to come only in January, hopefully with a new president, a new House, and ideally a new Senate as well. And that's really a long way off, given how much people are suffering today.
I mean, it's It's a real long way off when you contemplate the idea that we're only 4 months into this, right? In terms of like when the first wave hit the beach, if you will, we're only 4 months into this, and there's not that at least in the context of New York, and I mean I think like this is. The failure of the federal government to act, and in fact, I would say it's even worse than their failure to act. I mean, they actively worked against what are the minimum basics you need. I mean, just the fact that you are a professional writer writing about this on a regular basis, and the fact that we can't even articulate in a way that is understood across the board as to whether this is the first or the second wave is indicative of the fact that there has been such a disparate reaction to this, right? Like I don't know if we could say it's a first wave, but that's a function of where you are in the country. I mean, that's the thing, is that we can't even define a lot of these terms because of the haphazard way in which the response has taken place.
It's been totally criminal at the federal level in particular. I mean, I mentioned, the testing issues. There has been literally no federal initiative to coordinate or fund the rollout of testing at any mass scale. We're going through PPE.
There's hostility towards testing. Absolutely. Every day Donald Trump has an interview and is asked about a question, he expresses hostility towards testing. And so just to be clear with everybody, I want to just tease out that point that you made. We're testing a lot more people, but relative to the spread of the disease, we are actually lagging where we were back in April. Right. The disease has spread. The virus has spread so much that the amount that we're testing is now insufficient. And like you say, our testing capacity, because a test that you get back in 12 or 14 days is definitionally useless. It's telling you something that is literally useless information at that point.
Yeah. And, we were told early on in the spring that we needed to do absolutely everything that we needed to suppress the spread at least enough to prevent hospitals from being overwhelmed. And now in certain parts of the country, they are being overwhelmed. Arizona has activated what they call their crisis standards of care, which means they're basically allowing hospitals to make decisions about who to treat and not to treat because the hospitals are so full up that they can't treat everybody who comes in. The ICUs are already overfilled in all through Florida. Dozens of counties in Florida. And the scariest and maybe most depressing thing about it is that while that seemed like a horrible prospect when we first heard about it in February and March, and we were like, we needed to do absolutely everything we could to prevent it from happening, it's happening now. And the public doesn't really bat an eye. Obviously there is enormous concern about this disease and its spread, but I think simultaneously we are really normalizing an enormous amount of suffering and pain and dying that we really, really by any moral standard should not be. And when you look at what's happened elsewhere in Europe, I think it's especially kind of illustrative and showcases just how much of a failure we are walking through, because the countries of Europe also failed at first. In general, all the countries of the West didn't adequately understand the scale of the threat when it first arose in Asia. You look at other countries in Asia, they saw what was going on in China and they freaked out because they knew how serious it was. Nobody across the West did that, which meant that everybody was caught flat-footed at first, and everybody, just about everybody, had a really bad first set of experiences with this disease, as the U.S. did. So on some level, you can't fault the initial failure. You can't fault us for the initial failure because all of our peer countries did the same. But all of those other peer countries took the opportunity of lockdowns to build out public health infrastructure, testing capacities, contact tracing, and also to really inform the public about what was needed to do to suppress the spread of the disease, such that every single other country, all of our peer countries, have really dramatically turned the corner on this. And in many parts of Europe, it's basically over. Like, they're going to still have some cases here and there, but there's so much public health focus on the disease that they have it completely under control in a totally reliable way. Here in the U.S., we've basically given up. And that is really depressing, distressing, and horrifying, given that, you know, we're at 135,000 deaths now. The best projection models by this guy, Yu Yang Gu, suggest that we're going to have, by November 1st, about 225,000. So we're only about halfway through the dying that we're likely to see by Election Day. And, of course, we're learning every day that this disease really damages you even if you survive. There are patients who had quote-unquote mild experiences of the disease who have noticeable damage in their lungs and in their hearts. We don't know how long that'll last. We don't know how pervasive it is. But this is a really horrifying disease whose cost is much bigger even than the 135,000 people who've died or the 225,000 who are likely to die, which, given the scale of those numbers, you know, it's just a moral abomination to think that they don't even contain the scale of the suffering. The scale of the suffering and pain is much, much bigger still.
Let me ask you just a couple of questions about what you just said. In terms of long-term damage, do we have any sense of, like, are there numbers out there? I mean, I have heard there are potential long-term neurological damage, which, you know, certainly makes some sense. I mean, certainly, like, you know, the pandemic of 1918, there was grave neurological issues associated with that flu. Some suggest that even Wilson, you know, you could draw a line from that flu and who caught it at the signing of the Treaty of Versailles to World War II. But do we have and also, like you say, the hearts, the lungs? I've heard of renal, a kidney failure. Do we have any numbers on that? And which then we can actually lead into the other question I had for you was, what are the implications of the White House announcing that the CDC is no longer going to be in the loop in collecting data, COVID-19 data, that it's going to be kept sort of like very close to the White House at Health and Human Services?
Well, on the long-term stuff, I think basically there have been no large-scale studies of long-term impact. So all that we have are a sort of handful of really small-scale studies, you know, where doctors looked at, you know, a patient group of, say, 20 or 30 patients. And there are some really worrying signs in a lot of those studies, but they are quite small-scale, and it's not yet clear exactly what to make of them. We do know that in the short term, as people experience, you know, acute, severe sickness from COVID, they exhibit symptoms in basically every organ you got. And, you know, doctors have, over the course of the disease, stopped thinking of it primarily as a respiratory disease and started thinking of it in part as a blood clotting disease. It does seem to really do a lot of damage through blood clots, which, you know, can cause damage almost everywhere in the body. And you see damage just about everywhere in the body, not in every single patient, but, you know, at the population level, you see people who have, kidney failure, liver failure, heart failure, lung failure, neurological damage, you know, people suffering in their toes and their eyes, sense of smell goes away. All of these things show just how creative this virus is in attacking us. The long-term picture of that is not yet clear, but the more that we learn, the more that we hear, it's sort of anecdotal, but it adds up to something I think quite concerning, is that even people who have mild cases of the disease, or people who had relatively severe experience but then survive, are many of them are going to be dealing with long-term consequences, to some degree. We don't know exactly in what ways, but it's scary. It's something I think most people haven't really quite come to terms with or appreciated yet. The CDC question is, it's a complicated one because, the CDC has really done a pretty terrible job through the pandemic. Right. So I want to see that institution restored and built back up and given some more of its political independence that was taken away during the Trump years. But, my own feeling is that I haven't been trusting the CDC as a clearinghouse for data for quite a while. In fact, I've found a lot of the sort of independent journalistic dashboards that have been put together, like, by The Atlantic, for instance, to be a much more useful database, or the website Our World in Data does it really well too. So I think it's like it's a symptom of the the Trump era disease in which everything has to be managed by at the federal level by the White House, while also the White House and the federal government refuses to do anything about anything. That they're taking away this role of the CDC. But I think at least in the short and medium term, it's not going to meaningfully change our understanding of the disease or our ability to see patterns. What's really striking is that most of the large scale data analysis that's been done on this disease to this point has come from abroad, from Chinese scientists, from European scientists. Even though now in July and now for a few months, the U.S. has been by far the biggest share of the disease globally,
right.
Which is on its own quite amazing to contemplate that this is, the world's richest nation. As recently as the Ebola outbreak in 2014, it was not just the kind of leading figure in the global health community, but the dominant funder and provider of human resources in any pandemic outbreak anywhere in the world is now. We haven't just failed in that role. We haven't just abandoned that leadership role. We have so totally failed that we have become the most acute incubator of the disease all around the world. The entire outbreak in Latin America, almost all of that is coming from the United States. And we are the ones who are adding more cases every day than basically everybody else in the world. That is an incredible fall from prominence to literally the depths of public health suffering and indifference. And it's happened, if you count the Ebola outbreak as the starting point, it's happened in less than half a decade. A lot of that, of course, has to do with Donald Trump. But I also worry about the role of institutions like the CDC and the FDA, which have bungled the pandemic response in their own terms, even below the levels that Trump really, had any impact on himself.
What's happening in terms of university? I mean, now that you mention that, and sometimes it's difficult with these things to assess whether it, how much of it is just a function of I, as a reader of news, and no longer pay attention to certain things, or maybe editors, producers of news are like, people don't want to read about this anymore, so we're not going to do these stories. But I do remember 2 or 3 months ago, every other day it was French scientists or doctors say found this attribute, or Italian doctors were warning about that attribute, or Chinese doctors were reporting this or that. And I don't see those type of reports like being generated in this country. And like you say, we have the opportunity we have the raw product, as it were. And I guess maybe the last thing that I heard was the use of steroids to in some ways diminish the impact of the psychotine storms. But you, as somebody who's been following this on your beat, are you still seeing a steady stream of studies that are pointing to certain things, or have you told me about that in terms of like the possible long-term implications of people who have recovered?
I think in general, we have a clearer sense of how the disease progresses through the period from, the kind of 1 month period from the time you get it to the time where most people are, have either died or basically pass through to the other side of it. We don't have a very clear sense of the long-term implications, but that's more because, you know, we're only a few months into this pandemic generally. And so we'll learn more about that going forward. But I think there's not that much more to learn. We figured out a lot of these blood clot issues that's helped in treatment. And we have made some sort of marginal breakthroughs in some therapies, some things that, you know, help cut lethality, you know, 10, 20, 30%, which is significant, but not kind of game changing. Some of the questions that I'm most interested in terms of research these days are about matters of that may tell us something more about the future course of the disease epidemiologically, and in particular about a number of questions around the immune response. So, you know, at this point, we often talk about the measuring the degree of spread of the disease through a community through these serological tests. They test to see if you have antibodies in your blood, and basically, you know, New York is the place that has had the highest level anywhere in the world. It's somewhere, depending on the test, somewhere between 20 and 25% of the population has antibodies to COVID. But we've also starting to see longitudinal serological surveys that show that antibodies decline quite rapidly, especially in people who had a mild case of the disease, such that a significant portion of them just 3 months after they were sick don't show any antibody levels at all in these tests. And the question is, does that mean that they're vulnerable to reinfection? I think the answer to that, having talked to a number of immunologists, is no, and that in fact you can have an immune response that's embedded in so few antibodies that they don't show up on a test, but is still sufficient to fight off a reinfection. In fact, that's a quite common dynamic of diseases like COVID. But what that means then for how we should think about that 20 to 25% number, I think, is complicated. You know, if there are some number of people who have sufficient immunity but who don't have antibodies, then in fact the disease has spread further than that 20 to 25% and maybe getting us closer to a level of spread that would provide some limited, at least, degree of you know, herd immunity, because herd immunity is not something that happens just when you hit the threshold of 60%. It's a matter of, you know, if more people in the population are protected, that means it's harder for the disease to spread. And therefore, even in an unregulated way, it would spread slower than in a population that was totally, quote unquote, virgin. There are also really interesting questions around.
So just to be clear, be clear on that, at least my understanding going into this, that, you know, you needed 60 to 70% of a population to have developed some form of immunity to it, whether it's by vaccination or by having been infected before and maintaining antibodies. But there are, I have been reading as of late that there is, you can have a form of herd immunity with numbers that are lower depending upon, you know, other factors that may take place. I mean, if
there's sort of two separate questions. The first is, like, how many people in the community have been exposed, and does an antibody test tell you that, or does an antibody test underestimate the number of people who've been exposed? It seems to me likely that it underestimates it by some degree, although to what degree we don't yet know.
Right.
Then there's the question of whether herd immunity could be achieved at a spread, you know, at a degree of spread that's like south of 60% of the particular community. And there is some open debate and conversation about this. I don't know exactly what to make of it, but there are serious people.
Right. It's hard to know whether or not that's aspirational. Aspirational at this point.
But the thing that's sort of most interesting to me, there have been a couple of recent papers just in the last day, and then some others over the last month or 6 weeks, have been about what's called T cells are one aspect of the immune system, and there have been some large scale studies showing that a significant portion of the population who have not been exposed to COVID-19 have already a T cell immune response to it, which they basically have because the disease is enough like other coronaviruses that those people have been exposed to that the immune response is transferable. Now, we don't yet know what level of protection precisely that it's called cross-reactive immunity would offer. Some people I've spoken to suggest it could be quite dramatic and may even effectively eliminate the risk of severe disease. So you might get COVID, but you won't get really sick from it. Other people have been more measured and say the most we can say is that it would trigger a faster immune response and would probably mean a shorter period of symptomaticity. But even that would be good news. And, you know, the measure of how many people have this is different studies have shown different things, but it seems likely that at least half the population has some amount of T-cell cross-reactive immunity. And that may mean, in a maximalist reading, trying to give you a little hope, that may mean that some significant portion of the people who haven't yet caught this disease are less at risk of the worst case outcomes than the people who we've seen experience those outcomes to this point. Now, that's very speculative. I don't know exactly what the likelihood that we land there is, but I think there's a lot of really interesting research around the immune response, the antibody response, and particularly the T-cell response that may somewhat dramatically change our shape, change our sense of what the likely sort of future shape of the pandemic will be.
That is a derivation of the theory that applies also to the idea of, like, you know, in New York, the response was completely bungled by Cuomo in moving patients into nursing homes. But there is some talk of, like, the kindling, as it were, the most susceptible people to the disease have been impacted once it comes through a region, I guess.
It's definitely the case that some people are able to what's called shed the virus more prolifically than others. There's some thinking that there may also be people who are more susceptible, but that may be tied up in this T cell question. But it's not it's all kind of speculative at this point. What's clear though is that it's quite striking that all around the world, we've had all of these outbreaks in all of these different cities, which have all of these different levels and qualities of public health guidance and political leadership, who intervened at various points in the spread of the disease in those communities. And nowhere in the world have we seen serological surveys showing something more than 25% of the population exposed. Now, early on, especially when we're talking about flattening the curve and saving the hospitals, we heard a lot about the risks of exponential growth, that if a disease can double in size in 2 or 3 days, it can get unbelievably large very, very quickly. And in that period of exponential growth, implementing social distancing policies or advising mask wearing 2 days later or 3 days earlier can make an enormous difference in the ultimate scale of the outbreak. So given that dynamic, the fact that nowhere in the world has any city gone north of 25% does suggest to me that there may be some protective features going on that do sort of limit the ceiling of damage from COVID. I don't know enough. I don't think anybody knows enough to say for sure what those would be, but it is striking that nowhere in the world has the pandemic produced at least an antibody response in larger than a quarter of the local population.
That is fascinating. And I guess, like, at this point, wearing a mask and grabbing onto anything that's hopeful is helpful. Let me just ask you two or three more questions that I think are people have generally. Why are the deaths in places like Arizona and Texas, California, where we're seeing in Florida, where we're seeing this explosion of cases? Some of it is we're just more aware of how many cases there are. Some of it is it's a lagging indicator, although we have some distance here from that. So we would anticipate if we were like New York. Some of it is there's a awareness that, like, hey, you don't put patients near nursing homes. You need to really lock down those communities. Some of it is, I would imagine, older people are that much more sensitive to it. What else do you think is and we're seeing deaths creep up, maybe accelerate even more than that. But what do you think is at play here?
Well, I think all of the factors you described, I think there are also treatments are improving. Like I said, they're improving at the margins, but that matters. And, you know, I think we will likely see deaths, the absolute number of deaths in all of these places and across the country continuing to grow. But I do suspect that the trends will continue in that the sort of ratio of cases to deaths will grow, so that we'll have fewer deaths for the same number of cases that we saw earlier in the spring, for all of the reasons you describe. I mean, really big picture, something like half of all deaths in the U.S. from COVID-19 have been in nursing homes.
Right.
So at just implementing common sense policies about how to protect those populations would make an enormous difference in the death rate. Beyond that, a clearer understanding of the vulnerable populations outside of nursing homes, people in their 70s and 80s and 90s, people who have, you know, any number of these, comorbidities, transplant patients, cancer patients, et cetera. If those people have even a marginally better sense of how serious the disease is and what they need to do to protect themselves, that would help somewhat significantly. Maybe a little more speculatively, you know, one of the hypotheses about why some people get a much worse version of the disease than others is about what's called the viral load, that if you're exposed to literally more viral particles, you may be much more likely to get a serious version of the disease. And if you're exposed to relatively fewer particles, you're likely to get a lighter version of the disease. Now, again, this is speculative, but if that is even a partial contributor to, you know, the matter of severity, then the fact that many, many more people are now wearing masks would mean that people would be getting a less severe form of the disease across the board. And I think that that is, you know, ultimately one of the chief failures of the American response. I talked earlier about testing and PPE, but ultimately the failure to advise early on that we all wear masks. In fact, for an extended period, we were advised against wearing masks.
Right.
Really is, I think, will prove to be a quite catastrophic failure. It wasn't unique to the U.S., but it had perhaps the worst impact here because if we told everybody to wear masks in February, almost none of the country would have had to go into lockdown. Maybe New York would, maybe a few other places, but that was basically it.
And to be clear, when we say masks, we're not saying N95 masks. We're saying wear a bandana, wear anything that would have kept you from projecting out the disease in as, you know, dense of a viral load or in as wide of a swath as possible. So with that said, tangentially, we are now weeks and weeks out from some of the biggest protests in New York. They're still ongoing in many respects, but in terms of the big ones and the first times that they showed up, and there has been no noticeable bump in terms of infections that have led from that protest. A lot of protesters were wearing masks. They all took place outside. How much does outside versus inside have to do with what we're seeing in terms of like the Northeast now? You know, we're still more or less either trending down or have stabilized on some level because people are outside more often, very easy to do at this time of year in the Northeast. But in places like Florida, Arizona, and Texas, Southern California, people go inside to get air conditioning. How much of that is going on there? And what does that mean for, are we going to get another flip essentially come November?
Well, a lot depends on the population dynamics of a place like New York. If New York has already gotten enough, infection that there's some natural population level immunity or protection, that could really protect against what's happening in the fall. But big picture, you know, I think outdoors, indoors is a huge part of this story. I think practically speaking, it's something close to impossible to get this disease outdoors. It's especially difficult to get it outdoors if you're, you know, being pretty rigorous about social distancing and, you know, trying to wear a mask when you're not social distancing. I think practically speaking, outside, it's more or less impossible to get the disease at all. It seems really easy to get the disease inside, especially in enclosed places where there isn't any fresh air, especially when you're in close proximity with other people. And, you know, the question of what that tells us about the fall, I think the risk that you're describing is real, but I also think it's likely that many of the situations in which we would be finding ourselves in close contact with other people in packed quarters inside, a lot of those are going to be suspended. Like, I don't think many people are going to be working in offices as they normally would have this fall anywhere in the country. I don't think that there are going to be bars open or restaurants open for indoor dining in many parts of the country. I don't think that there are going to be, you know, concerts going on indoors. And I don't think we're going to be having, you know, like NBA games or whatever, that where people are gathering 20,000 people in a building. I think all of that stuff is not going to be happening, which means that a lot of the places where you'd expect really bad spread to happen are sort of off the table. But it is obviously going to be harder to continue doing all the things that we want to do in the fall and into the winter outside in the northern parts of the country. And it's going to get considerably easier in the southern parts of the country, where today it is a lot harder. What that means for the spread of the disease, I think, has a lot to do with how we choose to respond to those conditions, how much we adapt our expectations for social gatherings, for professional work, and how much our, you know, especially in the red parts of the country, but really all across the country, how much our disregard for scientific advice, how much we disregard that scientific advice.
All right. So lastly, let me ask you this, and you didn't bring this up, schools. What is L.A. and San Diego have closed theirs for starting in the fall anyways. I should say they're doing remote learning. Don't know how long that'll last. I imagine that is provisional. Andrew Cuomo, talking about New York City has the largest school district in the country, 1.4 million, 1.2 million students. Andrew Cuomo has basically set up at least benchmarks for what it takes to open a school and what it would take to close a school. I think 5% infection rate gets you opened if you're doing it for 14 days. 9% gets you shut down in a community, more or less. We're not clear exactly how that's happening, but what is your sense? Like, what I keep hearing, I read reports that say, you know, first of all, we have very few deaths with kids with kids under the age of 17. We hear that it's very difficult for young kids, let's say elementary school kids, to transmit. Yet, I saw a story in Syracuse a week ago where a daycare center, maybe 9-10 people got it because a woman came in waiting on a test. Saw a story about, I think it was a school in Texas this week. What's your sense?
Well, you know, thinking globally, I think the facts you set out at the beginning are right. You know, kids are, practically speaking, not at risk for severe disease. There's some very small risk, but at a population level, it's practically speaking insignificant and not at a level at which, public policy would intervene in any other context. I think that the transmission, our understanding of the transmission risks is a little more muddied than you suggest. I think, you know, we don't really know how well kids transmit it. It seems likely that they do it less effectively than teenagers and teenagers less effectively than adults. But there's not zero transmission risk. The question is really about the relationship between the school and the community. And I think, you know, most epidemiologists would tell you now the most important factor for whether schools can open in a particular community is not how the school is set up. It's not how the classrooms are arranged and whether they're face masks or plastic dividers or whether they double their school size or whatever, how much social distancing has been put into place, et cetera. The most important factor is how much disease there is in the community, because those kids are going to be going home to their parents every day. They're going to be seeing other family members that are going to be interacting in the community, and as are, of course, the teachers and the staff at those schools otherwise. And because of the indoor dynamics that we were talking about earlier, schools represent a quite real risk. You can't do schools outside in New York City in January. Right. I do personally wonder why there wasn't more thought given to that in LA and San Diego, which do seem, at least from a weather perspective, like you could conceivably do some amount of school outside. Although, of course, there's also the matter of like real estate and space. But, my feeling is that when we look at Europe, they across the board have opened their schools now for a couple of months. And while there have been a couple of concerning flare-ups, it's really at the level of anecdote. It's like a school district here, a daycare center here. It's not like everywhere where schools have opened, there's been a disastrous flare-up of the disease. That to me suggests that, generally speaking, at the sort of global population level, while there is some risk to schools, you can manage it, and most communities will be fine so long as the disease is really suppressed in that community. Unfortunately, in the U.S., there are going to be very, very few places where the disease is suppressed to that level, and that means that the risk is considerably greater. And, frankly, it seems, I wish that we were prioritizing the opening of schools much more than we have been and invested in, say, building out new schools or claiming new real estate, hiring new teachers so we can make the class sizes smaller or whatever in order to make that happen. I also think, it doesn't seem impossible to roll out a kind of surveillance scale testing program within school systems, even if we're not able to do that across our country as a whole. If you look at what Harvard's doing, they're planning on testing their students every 3 days this fall in order to protect the on-campus experience, which, they want to protect mostly for business reasons. But because they're such a well-endowed, rich institution with an on-site, scientific lab facilities that can actually run these tests, they're basically going to be running a medical surveillance state there, and that will be sufficient to protect the student body. We should, in theory, be able to do that in the New York City school system or the LA school system or the San Francisco school system or any place in the country if we were willing to spend the capital, political and literal, to do it. Unfortunately, we've gotten to a point now where it's like it's the middle of July and it seems like we're only just beginning to talk about this problem.
Yeah,
and I don't think there's really any hope that it's going to be solved come early September.
David Wallace Wells, you're writing the first draft of a history, which I think historians are going to look back on this era and depending on the distance from today, with some laughter, but also just amazement at how tragically unnecessary so many of these deaths have been, and really just the immiseration that is bound to come in the wake of this, and maybe even during it. David Wallace Wells, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Great to talk to you again.
David Wallace Wells is the deputy editor and climate columnist for the New York Magazine and author of The Uninhabitable Earth. Hey, that's it for this week's Ring of Fire Radio. Special thank you to all of our free podcast subscribers who converted into members this week to help support the show. We cannot thank you enough. If you're listening to the free podcast, consider becoming a member of the full show over at rofpodcast.com. It is your support, again, that makes it possible for us to do this week in, week out. Don't forget, you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more. And you can check out my daily show. It's called The Majority Report. We're live every day at noon at majority.fm and then later as a podcast. Also, get your fix in the morning. 6 minutes of headline news from a left perspective. AM Quickie. You can sign up at amquickie.com or wherever your podcasts are served. I'm Sam Cedar, and this has been Ring of Fire.